It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is the busy summer home buying season, and the Wisconsin Realtors Association has just released its monthly housing report for June. According to the report, previously owned homes in Wisconsin showed a big jump in sales, and the median home price hit a new record, $340,000. To look more closely at what the numbers tell us, we turn to Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison. Kurt, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
The market report shows that home sales rose about 8% this June compared to last, and the association noted it's the first June increase in 4 years. June, of course, usually a very active month for closings. What should we make of this jump?
So it's a mixed signal. Like everything in the housing market these days, you can read the signals both ways, right? So it's positive to see a little movement in June, but if you look at the numbers for the first 6 months of the year compared to the first 6 months of last year, we're right at about the same pace. So we think that there were some sales in April and May that might have been delayed. People are sitting on the sidelines trying to read the tea leaves about tariffs and interest rates. And of course, interest rates, which really drives a lot of this, have not come down much since the beginning of the year. They've come down a little bit. So again, there's maybe signs of life because we want there to be a higher sales volume so that people can move, people can discover what the price is. People in the real estate market will tell you there's a little bit of difficulty getting buyers and sellers to come to an agreement on a price. So, you know, I don't know if that's a
that sounds like a mixed bag to me. Yeah. I checked this morning. Current mortgage interest rates in Wisconsin are right around 6.53% for a 30-year fixed. What effect are mortgage rates having on the housing market here?
Right. So there's a couple effects, right? So one of the things we want to say is that in Wisconsin, we have a greater percentage of our current homeowners who have mortgages less than 4% interest rate. So that's probably you and me. We all refinanced. So
during the pandemic.
So everything's stuck. There's not that kind of general churn and turnover. So low interest rates for people who already refinanced keeps them kind of locked in. And for first-time home buyers, what it means is that your dollar stretches less far to buy something that's more expensive. So we sometimes call that a double whammy. So, you know, the Federal Reserve has not moved a lot of on interest rates. And even if they did, mortgages are priced based on the 10-year Treasury note, which really reflects the expected cost of borrowing. So it's come down a tick. And so that is a little bit of good news. But, you know, I think I would tell people that the era of cheap money or 5% lower interest rates, we're not going to see that again probably in the next 10 or 20 years. And if we do, it means there's some sort of global financial crisis, which is or pandemic, neither of which are very good outcomes.
Not good outcomes. And, you know, nationwide, though, existing home sales dropped to a 9-month low in June. Yeah. Why aren't we seeing that same downturn in sales here?
Well, so the issue is that you have people who have, there's strong demand for housing, and we have this normal churn in the housing market as people are, you know, age out of their home or get married or get divorced or die. So there is that kind of standard churn that just always gives you some demand. But part of it is that we've seen that a good chunk of the sales are actually new homes, right? Because if you're locked in place and you can't buy a used home, you're looking at a new home. The problem is new homes are just really expensive to build right now.
Because of the materials and everything that goes into them?
Right. So the what we call the hard costs, which is both materials and labor, those are up 42% at least since the pandemic began.
Wow.
Right. I looked at numbers from the National Association of Home Builders. An average American home costs $100,000 more to build now than it did pre-pandemic, right? And for every $1,000 you raise the cost of a new home, you tend to raise the price of existing homes about the same. But that every $1,000 you increase the price, you price out significant number of families. And so as you particularly see, older homebuyers with cash are outcompeting first-time homebuyers who maybe are finding it difficult to get a mortgage.
They have that equity.
They have that equity.
And they can turn that. Kurt Paulson with us, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, as we talk with him about the current housing market in Wisconsin in light of the June housing report from the Wisconsin Realtors Association that was just released. So let's talk affordability. Yep. According to this report, affordability of Wisconsin homes increased by 2.6% over the last year. It's a slight improvement over the record low affordability Wisconsin saw last June. How do you view housing affordability?
Right. So housing affordability, particularly for purchasing a home, is one of these deep conundrums or contradictions in our market. Because if you ask people, do you want house prices to go up or to go down? It depends. If you want to buy a house, you want the price to go down. If you want to sell a house or keep your house, you want it to go up. Mm. And affordability is really whether the middle-income family at the median can afford the median-priced home. The challenge of a statewide number is it really is going to include rural areas, older central cities, and then fast-growing areas like Madison or Waukesha County. So the challenge with affordability is, as we've seen, people like you and me in the middle of the income market, we're doing okay. We are able to find something to buy, but it's that first-time home buyer, it's that starting teacher or nurse that really is being squeezed. Because as the report shows, you know, houses under $300,000 sell really quickly. But there's not much at all. Or here in Madison, there's nothing under $400,000, which really means, you know, I got an email from a school board member the other day. What can we do about housing for teachers? And the answer is, well, not much, because it's just not much to buy. Right. So in terms of affordability, that first time home buyer, that kind of younger generation, they are really being squeezed.
And explain what are some of those broad-term effects when there is a lack of affordable housing in a Wisconsin community.
So if someone who works in your community, like a teacher or a nurse, a police officer, cannot afford to live near your community, then they might rent for longer, which, again, might be good for the rental market, but they're not able to build equity and not really to get that housing stability. Or they have to drive a long distance, right? We see that certainly in Dane County and even in Green Bay and Eau Claire area, where teachers are driving 30 to 45 minutes. The alternative would be maybe you buy a much smaller home, or you double up, or you take in a roommate. So it's less than ideal. And in the long term, if you can't build housing opportunities for the people working in your community, they have options and they'll go somewhere else. And so employers will tell you, again, it's just really hard to recruit or retain your workforce, particularly, again, that either entry-level service industry worker or even people at the middle of the income scale.
Can we check in for a moment what the state has been trying to do with workforce housing? We saw last month Governor Evers announcing $2.5 million in funding for new affordable housing developments. And it was part of a larger investment. Mm-hmm. So far, that money has supported the development of over 1,000 affordable housing units statewide. What can be done to create more workforce housing, more affordable units?
Right. So there's two big policy buckets that the state has. And so that first bucket that you're talking about is, on a bipartisan fashion last session, our legislature and governor agreed to $500 million, $500 million. And it's in a number of packages that include these great programs like Restore Main Street, where you're helping to build or remodel an apartment above a main street to really get that foot traffic and get that customer base. And the biggest component was really trying to deal with the land and the infrastructure costs for new housing development. And it was a great program. It is a great program. It has been kind of a slow rollout because there are just multiple headwinds to building new workforce housing, including construction costs and interest rates. And so on the financing side, what the state is doing, you really need to think about every tool you have, every subsidy you have, to help bring down those costs, to speed up approval times, to lower infrastructure costs. But you're fighting against upstream issues in terms of costs and interest rates and land costs. And then on the second bucket we like to talk about is for local governments and states thinking about various sorts of zoning and building codes, all of these kind of multiple little regulations that really constrain how much housing can be built and what type of housing. So in a lot of our communities, one of the reasons we don't build a starter home is you really can't. It's illegal because you can't build that kind of small house on a small lot, the type of housing that we used to build a lot of in this state. So we've seen a lot of states move on zoning reform. We have not yet seen Wisconsin move in that direction. I suspect we will see a lot of momentum in the coming years. But we're really excited about this $500 million, $525 million from the legislature. And there's bills right now to kind of speed up the process and pair that funding with other sources. But it's a long road to kind of travel.
There used to be that rule of thumb, no more than 30% of your monthly income toward housing. People are being squeezed by cost of living, grocery bills. What might that realistic share of a housing payment on, you know, for a family be now?
Well, the problem is it's going to be capped really at 31% of your income, because almost everyone who lends is going to be subject to the either Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac rules that come from the federal government. And so there's really not a lot of wiggle room to go above that if the bank wants or the mortgage company wants to sell it on the secondary market. So, you know, that is one of the ways that families can adjust is spend more of their income on housing. But that's not a sustainable long-term policy or financial strategy for homeowners. So what really we see in the housing market is that there's millions of families that would have purchased that just can't purchase now because of these rules.
Kurt, thank you so much for the update. Thanks for joining us.
Good to see you.
Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison, joined us for a look at the housing market in Wisconsin as sales figures for existing homes were released for June. Coming up, over 100,000 people in our state live with epilepsy. A pharmacist and researcher talks about the latest anti-seizure treatments.
We can't necessarily isolate what's causing that electrical storm to start. You know, we're learning more. We're learning, you know, every day, I think, about the genetics.
That's ahead on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More than 100,000 people in Wisconsin are living with epilepsy. This neurological disorder can be developed at any age. The brain uses electricity to function, but surges of electrical activity can trigger recurring seizures. According to UW-Madison Professor of Pharmacy Dr. Barry Goodall, epilepsy patients have more treatment options than ever with fewer side effects and interactions. Dr. Goodall is here to talk about developments in epilepsy treatment and anti-seizure medications. Welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
What does a pharmacist like yourself bring to the healthcare team who would be treating a patient at an epilepsy center?
Great question. Thank you for asking. You know, I think a lot of people, when they when they view a pharmacist, maybe their main interaction with a pharmacist is when they go pick up a prescription. And that's what certainly a lot of, you know, pharmacists do, and they're available to talk about, you know, the prescriptions. But we also train pharmacists to be what we call clinical pharmacists, meaning that they have roles within, you know, a whole variety of places, clinics, hospitals, you name it, where they're actually directly helping to manage the sometimes very complex medications that our patients take. So for example, I actually, you know, directly see patients in clinic, you know, much like a nurse practitioner might take care of patients, but I really focus on the medicines and managing them.
Do you feel like that brings you closer to a patient's story that then involves how you would proceed in managing their meds?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, in my practice, I've had patients now that I've been doing this since 1991. So I've had patients I've been following for 30 years. And some of my women have had a couple kids that are now out of college. And so, yeah, I have a lot of patients. I've been, you know, really one of their primary caregivers for a long time. So absolutely, you get involved with the lives and the stories.
Can you take us into these seizures and describe what constitutes a seizure and how they're classified and what happens in the brain?
Sure. You know, I think, again, what a lot of people who don't have the lived experience, meaning they don't, you know, have epilepsy or have a close friend or family, you know, what we think of seizures is, you know, frankly, what you see on television, right? They
Yes.
always depict it as a big convulsion. And that certainly happens to a lot of our patients. But, you know, if you think of what a seizure is, it's sort of this sudden, massive electrical activity, like a storm that takes place in the brain. And where it starts, you know, think of it as like a small campfire. Where it starts burning, what part of the brain, is kind of what you're going to see. So a lot of our patients, it's very subtle. They may, you know, stop talking or have some sort of other kind of behavioral arrest, or they may get really confused or look like they're spacing out, or maybe, depending on what part of the brain, maybe one side of their body starts jerking or they have an unusual sensation. So, you know, it kind of, that's what makes us such an interesting disease and a difficult one sometimes to take care of, because the seizures can vary, you know, from person to person. So again, if you think of that small little campfire, small little fire starting, you know, sometimes that fire can spread, and that's when we see the bigger things like these convulsions. So it's a very individualized disease, if you will.
To what extent can your patients predict or anticipate these seizures?
Well, you know, some people can. Some people will tell you, and this is where you really have to get into hearing the story. And this is also what I would encourage your listeners out there, if they've got the lived experience, if they're living with epilepsy or know somebody, make sure your provider is really hearing the whole story. Because I'll have some patients, they know that day they're going to have an episode, and maybe they'll know in a few seconds before, or maybe in, you know, a few minutes before. But a lot of patients simply don't know. And the other interesting thing about this, depending on the part of the brain, especially the part of the brain that controls our memory, so the temporal lobes of the brain, a lot of times patients will have a seizure and they don't remember it. Yeah, so this is again why it's really important, you know, for I try as often as possible to get family members to come to clinic as well. So, because they're usually the best observer.
How hard are these seizures on the brain, especially over the course of decades?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. There's a growing body of evidence that uncontrolled seizures over time can affect, you know, cognition and memory. There's just a lot that we're continually learning, a lot we still don't know.
Epilepsy can be so debilitating. Why is it so difficult to find a cure?
You know, part of it is because, again, the brain is such a, you know, complex, you know, organism, or organ, I should say. And again, depending on where that electrical problem is, again, if you think of the brain as a big wired machine, right? And something is shorting out somewhere. Sometimes we have things we can identify what's causing it. Say it's a brain tumor, or if there's a specific, you know, defect somewhere in the brain that our surgeons, our neurosurgeons can go out and take that out. And sometimes we can really resolve it and make patients seizure free. But other times we just can't. We can't necessarily isolate what's causing that electrical storm to start. So it's, you know, we're learning more. We're learning, you know, every day, I think, about the genetics and about the neurobiology, you know, what's the underpinnings of this. But the brain's a complex organ, really is.
What excites you about the hive of research going on? Because you also are in the thick of research. What is exciting?
Well, you know, I know as a pharmacist, you would probably expect me to say the drugs, new drugs, and that certainly is, and we can talk about that. But I think for me, it's two areas. One is, again, as we learn more, I just mentioned about the genetics, as we learn more about what is actually happening here that's causing the problem. And there's great, you know, research that I hope is able to continue looking at things like gene therapy. I mean, these are in the very nascent early stages. You know, really where we're getting at, what's the fundamental problem that maybe we can fix? I also think devices, you know, some of the things that we have that I'm certainly not an expert in, where, you know, electrical devices that maybe we can, you know, do different types of stimulation within the brain that we might be able to sort of, you know, abort the seizure as it's really getting started. So I think there's some really interesting stuff from a basic science that hopefully will, you know, make it to, well, they are, some of them already are making it to the clinic. And then the other thing is the newer drugs. I think we've got some exciting developments.
We're talking about epilepsy treatments with Dr. Barry Goodall. He's a professor of pharmacy at UW-Madison and works in adult epilepsy treatment research. He has a clinical practice in epilepsy in Madison. As you look at the different medications that are coming online, I also understand that certain types of cannabis can be used in the treatment of epilepsy. What are you finding there?
You know, we talk about, let me start with, you know, we use the term medical marijuana a lot. It's very nonspecific. You know, if you look at the cannabis plant, man, that's an incredible complex plant. And it's got, it doesn't just have one thing in it. Everybody thinks THC or maybe CBD. There's, you know, hundreds of different chemicals. Some may be good for our brains, some may not be. But the only cannabinoid that's been studied and now FDA approved for epilepsy is a purified form of cannabidiol or CBD. And that's really led to a lot of interesting new avenues of research. The drug works. The purified form, the FDA approved form of CBD really will work in a lot of different types of patients in different types of seizures. So it's really pretty exciting, but it's not cannabis. It's one molecule out of that plant.
You also learned as CBD as a treatment option that some of these products are not correctly labeled. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's some work that came out of our lab and some other collaborations a couple of years ago now. That, you know, because of the so-called Farm Bill, you know, I mentioned there's an FDA-approved prescription form of CBD, but there's lots of, you can go anywhere, right? You can go anywhere and you can buy, you know, different CBD oils or tinctures or whatever. Not the same thing. Hmm. And so one of the concerns that we had, we looked just with here within the state of Wisconsin, we looked at lots of different over-the-counter forms of CBD that were being sold out there without a prescription. And we found lots of contamination. We found a lot of them had far less CBD than what the label indicated. A lot of them, about a third, as I recall, were contaminated with had THC in it, you know, which would be of concern if you're giving this to your child to try to treat for seizures or anything else. We also, in a different study, found contamination with some heavy metals like lead and some other metals. So there's then the over-the-counter world, there's lots of concerns about the product purity, if you will.
Has that changed your, are you more cautious then about using CBD protocols for a patient, or is that just in over the counter options?
Yeah, I think the prescription CBD most clearly has a role, and it should be considered as an alternative. The over the counter stuff, you know, this is buyer beware, and because I'm concerned about what other stuff is in there. It's also very expensive, and you know, insurance companies won't cover that kind of thing. And also the doses, you know, the doses of the prescription product that we use to treat seizures, and we know from clinical trials it works. You really can't achieve those doses with the over-the-counter stuff. You just can't without spending a lot of money and drinking a lot of bottles.
Mm. So would CBD treatment prescriptions be used in concert with other anti-seizure medications or to replace them?
Well, right now, what we found from the clinical trials and what I think our clinical experience has been is to add CBD onto somebody's already existing anti-seizure medicine regimen. So in other words, we get a patient who comes in still having seizures. We've tried a couple different, let's call them more traditional anti-seizure drugs. CBD might be an option for them. We'll add that on to their existing regimen. We need to be mindful about drug interactions because CBD can cause some drug interactions. That's my other concern about people in the over-the-counter world that are not, you know, talking with their physician, pharmacist, nurse practitioner, whoever, that are using this. It may interact with other medicines they're taking. So right now, it's mainly we see it as an add-on or adjunct to other medicines.
Do patients at the Epilepsy Center have access to the latest clinical trials and trials going on around the country? How is that working?
Yes, we're actively engaged at the university in clinical trials for epilepsy, both from, you know, looking at those devices we talked about, as well as, you know, new drugs that are coming onto the market or being investigated, I guess I should say, before approval. So, you know, this is one of the things that I encourage, you know, I would encourage your listeners, encourage people if they're, you know, if they're struggling with epilepsy, or even if their seizures are under pretty good control, which in my mind means being seizure free, but they're having side effects, I think it's worth going, you know, trying to seek out an epilepsy center. You know, whether it's, you know, here in Madison or out in Milwaukee or, you know, La Crosse. I mean, we're really blessed in the state of Wisconsin. We've got some really good high-level epilepsy centers. But to go have, you know, a different set of eyes, maybe look at that and see if you're a candidate for different clinical studies or the newest medicines.
In the research community, you know, these different research projects can be years, maybe decades. There has been a lot of disruption recently in research funding, especially related to the National Institutes of Health. Is epilepsy being affected?
Oh, sadly, yes, it is. And this is hitting everybody, not just here at University of Wisconsin. This is hitting every investigator across the country. Funds are drying up, grants are being canceled. I worry about this. I worry about, you know, and it's not just the clinical studies, but, you know, I was talking earlier about some of the basic science work. You know, some of the things take years, as you just mentioned. You know, we've got to have the basic science to really understand if we want to develop, say, a target for one of these medicines or come up with an idea for a new medicine. If the funding stops and the funding goes away, that's only going to impede things in progress. So I clearly worry about it.
You've spent so much of your career immersed in this neurological disorder. what gives you hope about epilepsy?
You know, one of the things, and, you know, you just acknowledge I've been doing this for a while. And, you know, one of the things that I will tell you keeps me in doing what I'm doing, and, you know, I don't want to retire, you know, keeps me in here, two things. Number one, it's the patients. It's, you know, when I think that I can help and know that I can help, and I know what our patients, again, that lived experience, what they struggle with, it's really an opportunity to make a difference. But also from the scientific community, the clinical community, I'm talking nationally as well as, you know, here in the state, but nationally, internationally, this is just a really amazing group of people that are really committed to helping with this disease and helping our patients. And, you know, I refer to this as my extended family. I really do. And so it's an amazing group of people that are really very mission focused. You know, let's find a cure, or let's, you know, at least find the most effective treatment that we can. And how can we also improve our patients' quality of life?
Dr. Goodell, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, again, thank you for the invitation.
That is Barry Goodell, a professor of pharmacy at UW-Madison, whose research focuses on adult epilepsy treatments. He's also a clinical pharmacist practitioner. The Wisconsin Epilepsy Foundation's next Walk to End Epilepsy is set for August 16th in Appleton and September 20th in Milwaukee. Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, our state's AmeriCorps VISTA Member of the Year is wrapping up his work with free and charitable clinics on a mission to improve public health.
I was in clinical medicine, and I decided to take a massive detour in my career towards public health.
That conversation is next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The VISTA program, which stands for Volunteers in Service to America, traces its roots back to 1965 and President Lyndon Johnson's anti-poverty efforts. In the 1990s, the program was merged with another national service organization, AmeriCorps. But the programs face an uncertain future now that President Trump has cut $400 million in funding and ended grants for about 32,000 service workers. The program's fate is being fought in the courts. In recent months, Governor Evers recognized a dozen service members and volunteers working to improve life in Wisconsin. Many of them work for AmeriCorps. Bharat Shetty was named AmeriCorps VISTA Member of the Year. Shetty finishes his tenure with the Wisconsin Association of Free and Charitable Clinics next month. Bharat, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell us about what work you've been doing for the Wisconsin Association of Free and Charitable Clinics? What do you have your hands on?
With the Wisconsin, with WOFC, my service was focused on supporting the network of free and charitable clinics that serve people who either don't qualified for Medicaid or fall into that coverage gap where they're still uninsured or underinsured. A lot of these folks are working jobs that don't offer benefits, or they're in communities where access to affordable care is already limited. So the needs of these clinics or that they serve are very big but familiar. They do chronic disease management, dental access, behavioral health services, specialty care. And a lot of my work was behind the scenes. I helped clinics build capacity so they could better serve the communities. That meant everything from creating health communication campaigns to coordinating webinars to developing tools that WOMC could use to tell their story or advocate for policy change. at the heart of it, I guess. My goal was to help WFC and in turn the clinics the organization serve have resources, visibility, and support they need to keep going and grow.
I wonder, are there unmet public health needs or ways that you could build capacity that could be solved with perhaps better technology in free and charitable clinics?
Yeah, that's a large part of it. I mean, we're always trying to find new partnerships to come in from other organizations that kind of deal with this. We have partnerships with helping us with language translation. So organizations like Genie have been very instrumental in helping us bridge those language gaps. We also are exploring other we're trying to build partnerships with charitable organizations that provide specialty diagnosis and consultancy, as well as even dermatological consultancy as well. So we're trying to find ways to bring these important services to the clinics to help them expand their reach and what they can do for their patients.
Are these clinics that you see, do they have issues with waiting lists or not ability to serve all people who come to the door?
Yeah, that certainly is an issue. These clinics are seeing an increase in patient load and they can only do so much. These clinics are primarily funded through private donation or grants and do not... They don't really accept any sort of payment for their services. And so, yeah, capacity is challenging for these clinics. And so that's also a big reason why AmeriCorps, comes in and help bridge that gap where gaps of employment and help that they need.
I understand that before you went into public health, you were thinking about becoming a doctor and you went to med school in India. What prompted you to change course and focus on public health?
While working in India, after med school, I've spent some time working there. And I'd say my path to public health really started there while I was practicing in rural and underserved areas. Most of the patients I saw came in with this some combination of obesity, hypertension, or diabetes, what we often call as the big three chronic diseases. But over time, I realized those conditions weren't just clinical. They were symptoms of much deeper issues tied to lifestyle, tied to environment, and a basic lack of access to even basic health and nutritional knowledge. And so it started to feel like I was putting out fires instead of addressing what was actually fueling these issues. I could prescribe medication, I could give advice, sure, but that didn't seem to help someone who couldn't afford healthy food or didn't know what was driving their illness in the first place. That realization really shifted my focus, and I wanted to move upstream to work on prevention, education, and the systems that shape health on a community or population level. And so that's what really pulled me towards public health. I didn't really stop caring about the individual patients. I just really started caring more about the conditions that and the systems that they were living in.
What similarities or perhaps differences in the health needs are there between people that you see living in the United States versus in India?
I would say at first glance, the healthcare systems in India and the U.S. seems world apart. One's a developed country, one's a developing country. But once you're on the ground, especially working with low-income or marginalized communities, the parallels become abundantly clear. In both places, I've seen how poverty, education, and access, or lack thereof, plays a massive role in health outcomes. In India, it was common for patients to delay care because they couldn't afford it or didn't understand what symptoms meant. In the US, I've seen the same pattern, particularly among uninsured patients or those navigating complex systems like Medicaid. People fall through the cracks, not because they don't care about their health, but because sometimes the system just isn't built with them in mind. Another common thread I saw is the sheer importance of trust. Whether it's a rural village in India or a free clinic in Wisconsin, patients need to feel heard and respected. Building trust, building that trust really takes time, cultural awareness, and consistency. And it's often the key to helping people engage in their care and follow through. And so while the infrastructure and resources might be very different, the core challenges like health literacy, access, and equity are surprisingly similar. Hmm. In both places, community-based approaches and preventative cares really seem to make the biggest differences.
We're talking with Bharat Shetty, who is the AmeriCorps VISTA member of the year. He's finishing his tenure with the Wisconsin Association of Free and Charitable Clinics. Bharat, according to the AmeriCorps website, 8,400 people worked in Wisconsin last year, and they invested more than $44 million of federal and local funding around the state. What impact do you see these programs having in Wisconsin and quality of life here?
The AmeriCorps has been an essential to the work happening in free and charitable clinics across the state. These clinics run almost entirely on donations and grants. Most don't bill insurance or accept payment for care, so they rely heavily on volunteers and outside support, especially from the AmeriCorps members, AmeriCorps program. AmeriCorps members help keep things running. We support clinic operations. We manage data. We improve patient experience. We handle outreach and volunteers. We help clinics reach more people more effectively. I am incredibly proud to serve alongside my AmeriCorps cohort, because even after programmatic cuts earlier this year, we were placed on administrative hold. We were unsure what the next steps were. During that time, many of them continued to show up for their clinics, volunteering their time, staying involved however they could, and they continued serving their clinic communities that relied on them. Their dedication has been a constant source of inspiration. And what's even more encouraging is that several of them, at least six in our cohort, are either on their way to medical school or actively applying. AmeriCorps doesn't just support communities in the short term. It helps shape the next generation of healthcare providers and public health providers, practitioners who are grounded in service and equity. And so while these cuts were disheartening, I still remain hopeful. I've seen firsthand the impact of this program has on patients, on clinics, and on the people who serve. And I believe that if we continue to share these stories, more people, and hopefully those with the power to enact change, will see the value in it and step into support.
So you're saying that when the Trump administration canceled AmeriCorps VISTA grants earlier this year, that you saw you and your colleagues still meeting the needs of patients and continuing to do the work. How would you try to convince skeptics that this program is valuable and to justify it? What would you say?
Just look at how we contribute to the state. We prevent, through our service with the free and charitable clinics, we are stepping into full, we serve as volunteers stepping into full-time positions. We do this because we want to help. And it's also a valuable and integral part to our professional development. Prior to joining AmeriCorps, I entered the workforce with someone with a medical background, with a master's in public health, and I just wasn't getting the opportunities that I wanted. I was applying for jobs and I was not getting those roles. I was interviewing and every time they would tell me I was a great candidate, but I just didn't have the experience. Late one night surfing on LinkedIn, I came across Serve Wisconsin, and I decided to, Serve Wisconsin, that's an organization working with the AmeriCorps, I decided to apply. That ended up being one of the best professional decisions I ever made. Not only did I have the opportunity to serve with this incredible organization that's just focused on helping people and helping those who fall through those cracks of healthcare, but it also ended up being an integral part of my professional development, as because now after that, I've been given the opportunity to serve and work for other organizations post-service. And so it's not only is it just a on the side of health equity is important, but it's also important for young professionals trying to gain valuable work experience for their next steps.
Hearing you, it's so clear you believe wholeheartedly in this service mission and to help combat so many issues with people's health. When you did hear about the cuts, I wonder, what happened to morale in AmeriCorps and among your colleagues? What was that like?
Yeah. As I said, it was definitely disheartening. There were some scares earlier on where we didn't know what would happen. We were quite unsure, but then we kind of came through with it. I wasn't serving at that moment. I had actually gone to Mexico to get married. So that week I had gotten married. I found out I had won this amazing honor of the AmeriCorps Vista Member of the Year. And then 2 days after that, we found out that our program had been cut. And so it was definitely a roller coaster of emotions, to say the least. But we had great leadership within WAFC. I'd like to specifically say that, you know, Dominic Coffey, our AmeriCorps manager, and our executive director, Dennis Skryuski, really worked to make sure that we would be taken care of. They weren't sure what would happen next, but they wanted to make sure that we were supported in any way we needed. So whether it was making sure that we were being compensated, or if we had just to help us with opportunities that we may have to follow post AmeriCorps, such as, you know, job opportunities or whatever, they made sure to keep in constant communication with us and make sure that we weren't alone in this and that they supported us. Unfortunately, a lot of WAFC's efforts went into making sure that the AmeriCorps members were supported. And so I would say some attention was diverted towards us, but it does mean a lot that they recognized what we did and they wanted to support us in a way they could.
What can you take away from this experience that you think will guide your career in the future?
I would say that, you know, this has only strengthened my resolve as far as how I feel about public health. I was in clinical medicine and I decided to take a massive detour in my career towards public health, and I feel fulfilled. This has been an incredible experience, and I hope we see more AmeriCorps members in the future doing their part and learning from it and working towards contributing to a better and healthier future.
Well, Barath, thank you so much for your time. Congratulations on this award.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for having me.
That is Barath Shetty. Governor Evers named him the AmeriCorps Vista Member of the Year. Shetty finishes his tenure with the Wisconsin Association of Free and Charitable Clinics next month. Okay, you might already have it on your calendar, but just in case, National Mustard Day is Saturday. And to mark the occasion, we're looking into the tradition of mustard making here in Wisconsin and what goes into making unique and award-winning mustards. And we want to hear from you. Do you spread it on your sandwiches or line your brats with mustard? Do you prefer the yellow or the brown and why? And I really hope this doesn't turn into the cats versus dogs debate. I will hold back on telling you my preferences, but I will say that mustard is a key condiment and a wonderful ingredient in salad dressings. Share your thoughts on mustard. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us. The number is 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Avery Lee Rogers, and Joe Tarr. Our technical director is Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News. Thank you.